Chapter 5. Heard in the distance the voices of people going along a path. I slept. I rested. There was wild rice, water from a running stream, and peace. Every night I sat alone by my small fire before the hut. Many nights passed over my head. Then, one evening, as I sat by my fire after having eaten, I looked down on the ground and began to remember my wanderings. I lifted my head. I had heard no sound, no rustle, no footsteps, but I lifted my head. A man was coming towards me across the small clearing. I waited. He came up without a greeting and squatted down into the firelight. Then he turned his face to me. It was Matara. He stared at me fiercely with his big sunken eyes. The night was cold, the heat died suddenly out of the fire, and he stared at me. I rose and went away from there, leaving him by the fire that had no heat. I walked all that night, all next day, and in the evening made up a big blaze and sat down to wait for him. He had not come into the light. I heard him in the bushes here and there, whispering, whispering. I understood at last. I had heard the words before. You are my friend, kill with a sure shot. Apostrophe, apostrophe, I bore it, as long as I could, then leaped away, as on this very night I leaped from my stockade, and swam to you. I ran, crying like a child left alone and far from the houses. He ran by my side, without footsteps, whispering, whispering, invisible and heard. I sought people. I wanted men around me. Men who had not died. And again we two wandered. I sought danger, violence, and death. I fought in the Yatja war, and a brave people wondered at the valiance of a stranger. But we were two. He warded off the blows. Why? I wanted peace, not life. And no one could see him. No one knew. I dared tell no one. At times he would leave me, but not for long. Then he would return, and whisper or stare. My heart was torn with a strange fear, but could not die. Then I met an old man. You all knew him. People here called him my sorcerer, my servant and sword-bearer, but to me he was father, mother, protection, refuge and peace. When I met him, he was returning from a pilgrimage, and I heard him intoning the prayer of sunset. He had gone to the holy place with his son, his son's wife, and a little child. And on their return, by the favor of the Most High, they all died. The strong man, the young mother, the little child, they died. And the old man reached his country alone. He was a pilgrim, serene and pious, very wise and very lonely. I told him all. For a time we lived together. He said over me words of compassion, of wisdom, of prayer. He warded from me the shade of the dead. I begged him for a charm that would make me safe. For a long time he refused, but at last, with a sigh and a smile, he gave me one. Doubtless he could command a spirit stronger than the unrest of my dead friend, and again I had peace, but I had become restless, and a lover of turmoil and danger. The old man never left me. We traveled together. We were welcomed by the great. His wisdom and my courage are remembered where your strength, O white men, is forgotten. We served the Sultan of Sula. We fought the Spaniards. There were victories, hopes, defeats, sorrow, blood, women's tears. What for? We fled. We collected wanderers of a warlike race and came here to fight again. The rest you know. I am the ruler of a conquered land, a lover of war and danger, a fighter and a plotter. But the old man has died, and I am again the slave of the dead. He is not here now, to drive away the reproachful shade, to silence the lifeless voice. The power of his charm has died with him. And I know fear, and I hear the whisper, kill, kill, kill. Have I not killed enough? For the first time that night a sudden convulsion of madness and rage passed over his face. His wavering glances darted here and there like scared birds in a thunderstorm. He jumped up, shouting, by the spirits that drink blood. By the spirits that cry in the night. By all the spirits of fury, misfortune, and death, I swear someday I will strike into every heart I meet. He looked so dangerous that we all three leaped to our feet, and Hollis, with the back of his hand, sent the crisp flying off the table. I believe we shouted together. It was a short scare, and the next moment he was again composed in his chair, with three white men standing over him in rather foolish attitudes. We felt a little ashamed of ourselves. Jackson picked up the kris, and, after an inquiring glance at me, gave it to him. He received it with a stately inclination of the head, and stuck it in the twist of his sarong, with punctilious care to give his weapon a pacific position. Then he looked up at us with an austere smile. We were abashed and reproved. Hollis sat sideways on the table, and, holding his chin in his hand, scrutinized him in pensive silence. I said, "You must abide with your people. They need you. And there is forgetfulness in life. Even the dead cease to speak in time. Am I a woman, to forget long years before an eyelid is at the time to be twice?" he exclaimed, with bitter resentment. He startled me. It was amazing. To him his life, that cruel mirage of love and peace, seemed as real, as undeniable, as theirs would be to any saint, philosopher, or fool of us all. Hollis muttered, "You won't soothe him with your platitudes." Karen spoke to me. "You know us. You have lived with us. Why? We cannot know, but you understand our sorrows and our thoughts. You have lived with my people, and you understand our desires and our fears. With you I will go. To your land, to your people. To your people, who live in unbelief. To whom day is day, and night is night, nothing more, because you understand all things seen, and despise all else. To your land of unbelief, where the dead do not speak, where every man is wise, and alone and at peace." "Capital description," murmured Hollis, with the flicker of a smile. Karen hung his head. "I can toil, and fight and be faithful," he whispered, in a weary tone, "but I cannot go back to him who waits for me on the shore. No. Take me with you. Or else give me some of your strength, of your unbelief. A charm. He seemed utterly exhausted. "Yes, take him home," said Hollis, very low, as if debating with himself. "That would be one way. The ghosts there are in society, and talk affably to ladies and gentlemen, but would scorn a naked human being like our princely friend. Flayed. I should say. I am sorry for him. Impossible, of course. The end of all this shall be," he went on, looking up at us, "the end of this shall be, that someday he will run amok amongst his faithful subjects, and send ad patters ever, so many of them, before they make up their minds to the disloyalty of knocking him on the head." I nodded. I thought it more than probable that such would be the end of Karain. It was evident that he had been hunted by his thought along the very limit of human endurance, and very little more pressing was needed to make him swerve over into the form of madness peculiar to his race. The respite he had during the old man's life made the return of the torment unbearable. That much was clear. He lifted his head suddenly. We had imagined for a moment that he had been dozing. "Give me your protection or your strength," he cried. "A charm. A weapon." Again his chin fell on his breast. We looked at him, then looked at one another with suspicious awe in our eyes, like men who come unexpectedly upon the scene of some mysterious disaster. He had given himself up to us. He had thrust into our hands his errors and his torment, his life and his peace, and we did not know what to do with that problem from the outer darkness. We three white men, looking at the Malay, could not find one word to the purpose amongst us, if indeed there existed a word that could solve that problem. We pondered, and our hearts sank. We felt as though we three had been called to the very gate of infernal regions to judge, to decide the fate of a wanderer coming suddenly from a world of sunshine and illusions. "By Jove, he seems to have a great idea of our power," whispered Hollis, hopelessly. And then again there was a silence, the feeble plash of water, the steady tick of chronometers. J. Jackson, with bare arms crossed, leaned his shoulders against the bulkhead of the cabin. He was bending his head under the deck beam, his fair beard spread out magnificently over his chest. He looked colossal, ineffectual, and mild. There was something lugubrious in the aspect of the cabin. The air in it seemed to become slowly charged with the cruel chill of helplessness, with the pitiless anger of egoism against the incomprehensible form of an intruding pain. We had no idea what to do. We began to resent bitterly the hard necessity to get rid of him. Hollis mused, muttered suddenly with a short laugh, strength. Protection. Charm. He slipped off the table and left the cuddy without a look at us. It seemed a base desertion. Jackson and I exchanged indignant glances. We could hear him rummaging in his pigeonhole of a cabin. Was the fellow actually going to bed? Karen sighed. It was intolerable. Then Hollis reappeared, holding in both hands a small leather box. He put it down gently on the table and looked at us with a queer gasp, we thought, as though he had from some cause become speechless for a moment, or were ethically uncertain about producing that box. But in an instant the insolent and unerring wisdom of his youth gave him the needed courage. He said, as he unlocked the box with a very small key, "Look as solemn as you can, you fellows." Probably we looked only surprised and stupid, for he glanced over his shoulder and said angrily, "This is no play. I am going to do something for him. Look serious. Confound it. Can't you lie a little for a friend?" Karen seemed to take no notice of us, but when Hollis threw open the lid of the box his eyes flew to it, and so did ours. The quilted crimson satin of the inside put a violent patch of color into the somber atmosphere. It was something positive to look at. It was fascinating. Why, Hollis looked smiling into the box. He had lately made a dash home through the canal. He had been away 6 months, and only joined us again just in time for this last trip. We had never seen the box before. His hands hovered above it, and he talked to us ironically, but his face became as grave as though he were pronouncing a powerful incantation over the things inside. "Every one of us," he said, with pauses that somehow were more offensive than his words, "every one of us, you'll admit, has been haunted by some woman. As two friends dropped by the way. Ask yourselves." He paused. Karen stared. A deep rumble was heard high up under the deck. Jackson spoke seriously, "Don't be so beastly cynical." "Ah. You are without guile," said Hollis, sadly. "You will learn. Meantime this Malay has been our friend." He repeated several times thoughtfully, "Friend. Malay. Friend, Malay," as though weighing the words against one another, then went on more briskly, "a good fellow, a gentleman in his way. We can't, so to speak, turn our backs on his confidence and belief in us. Those Malays are easily impressed, all nerves, you know, therefore." He turned to me sharply. "You know him best," he said, in a practical tone. "Do you think he is fanatical, I mean very strict in his faith?" I stammered in profound amazement that did not think so. "It's on account of its being a likeness, an engraved image," muttered Hollis, enigmatically, turning to the box. He plunged his fingers into it. Karen's lips were parted, and his eyes shone. We looked into the box. There were there a couple of reels of cotton, a packet of needles, a bit of silk ribbon, dark blue, a cabinet photograph, at which Hollis stole a glance before laying it on the table face downwards. A girl's portrait, I could see. There were, amongst a lot of various small objects, a bunch of flowers, a narrow white glove with many buttons, a slim packet of letters carefully tied up. Amulets of white men. Charms and talismans. Charms that keep them straight, that drive them crooked, that have the power to make a young man sigh, an old man smile. Piant things that procure dreams of joy, thoughts of regret, that soften hard hearts, and contemporary soft one to the hardness of steel. Gifts of heaven, things of earth. Alice rummaged in the box. And it seemed to me, during that moment of waiting, that the cabin of the schooner was becoming filled with a stir invisible and living, as of subtle breaths. All the ghosts driven out of the unbelieving West by men who pretend to be wise and alone, and at peace all the homeless ghosts of an unbelieving world appeared suddenly round the figure of Alice bending over the box. All the exiled and charming shades of loved women, all the beautiful and tender ghosts of ideals, remembered, forgotten, cherished, execrated, all the cast out and reproachful ghosts of friends admired, trusted, traduced, betrayed, left dead by the way they all seemed to come from the inhospitable regions of the earth, to crowd into the gloomy cabin, as though it had been a refuge, and, in all the unbelieving world, the only place of avenging belief. It lasted a second, all disappeared. Hollis was facing us alone with something small that glittered between his fingers. It looked like a coin. "Ah, here it is," he said. He held it up. It was a sixpence, a jubilee sixpence. It was gilt. It had a hole punched near the rim. Hollis looked towards Karain. "A charm for our friend," he said to us. "See, the thing itself is of great power, money, you know, and his imagination is struck. A loyal vagabond. If only his Puritanism doesn't shy at a likeness." We said nothing. We did not know whether to be scandalized, amused, or relieved. Hollis advanced towards Karain, who stood up as if startled, and then, holding the coin up, spoke in Malay. "This is the image of the Great Queen, and the most powerful thing the white men know," he said, solemnly. Karain covered the handle of his kris in sign of respect, and stared at the crowned head. "The invincible, the pious," he muttered. "She is more powerful than Suleiman the Wise, who commanded the Genia, as you know," said Hollis, gravely. I shall give this to you." He held the sixpence in the palm of his hand, and looking at it thoughtfully, spoke to us in English. "She commands a spirit, to the spirit of her nation, a masterful, conscientious, unscrupulous, unconquerable devil. That does a lot of good, incidentally. A lot of good at times, and wouldn't stand any fuss from the best ghost out for such a little thing as our friend's shot. Don't look thunderstruck, you fellows. Help me to make him believe everything's in that. His people will be shocked," I murmured. Hollis looked fixedly at Karain, who was the incarnation of the very essence of still excitement. He stood rigid, with head thrown back. Gutenberg edition. End of chapter.